charge more. I've stolen this from Patrick McKenzie, somebody I've known for a long time on the internet. He used to say it all the time, charge more. Indie hackers are notorious for self-sabotaging themselves by not charging enough money. People who think that their product can have a free tier and a $9 per month tier, it's crazy. The economics don't work. Charge more. Get rid of the free tier. Start your pricing at $49. And if that scares you, try it and see what happens. Charge more.
Hi, and welcome to the Code and Conquer podcast. Today we're talking to Steve McLeod and about his product, Feature Upvote. We're talking about how Steve transitioned into his indie hacker life, the story behind Feature Upvote, and addressing his own pain points to find a valuable business idea. We'll also look at the pricing strategies and why indie hackers always charge too little. To top it off, we'll look at alternative products like a subscription business for coaching, which Steve does as well. This is a good one, full of valuable tips for all of you guys. I hope you enjoyed this one. Let's jump right in. And welcome to a new episode of the Code and Conquer podcast. And today I have Steve McLeod with me with his product Feature Upvote, which we will talk about. Steve, hi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tobias. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you're here mostly for the product Feature Upvote, which is bootstrapped in its own way. But we'll talk about one second. What did you do before you went down this bootstrapping and indie hacker route that you're on right now?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. I have a background as a developer, and immediately before striking out and doing my own thing, I was an overpaid IT consultant in Frankfurt, Germany, of all places. I'm actually from New Zealand. That's another story for another day about why I was in Germany. A job that paid well, but gave me very little job satisfaction. I was very unhappy doing that. And I had discovered online this community, now defunct, where people would share about running their own software companies and give each other advice and so on. Well before the term indie hacker existed, these guys and girls were the indie hackers. And I was just amazed at what they were doing. And I would just assume that they were hardly earning any money. And then one day, a couple of them actually shared their incomes, and you know, they were earning annually six figures after tax, and or after expenses at least. And I realized, oh, you can actually do this. And from that day forward, I knew that I was going to try to join their numbers. Took a couple of false attempts, but I finally managed to get there.
And now with your product Feature Upvote, you got there at the end. What is your product Feature Upvote? What does it do?
Feature Upvote lets your customers openly suggest and upvote ideas to improve your product. It's based on scratching my own itch and quite popular amongst product managers. I actually created it aiming it for people like you and me, like people running tiny software companies. But actually turned out not to be a very good market. And luckily, the market found me.
How did that happen? Like you said, product managers are project managers or product managers are your favorite target now?
Yeah, product managers, yeah.
Yeah.
I did the thing that they tell you to do, which is just launch, right? Just get something up there for people to see and start using. Because until you do that, you can't get any feedback. You don't know the right direction to go. Now, I created my original content and my original marketing plan aimed at these small self-run or bootstrap software companies. Then I looked at the customers we started getting, and we did get some customers from that target audience. They tend to churn pretty quickly because that type of company, we often fail. You know, you launch a company, you launch a product at least, it doesn't get traction, you close it down, and therefore you cancel all the things you're using. But amongst those early customers, I also saw like companies that were famous. I got Heidelberg Cement. So this was back when on every single new customer, I'd go and look them up and find out everything about them because I was just so excited to work out who is this person I do not know who just decided to put in a credit card and give me money every month. So I was looking them all up, and one was Heidelberg Cement. And I thought, that sounds familiar. So I looked them up, the world's biggest aggregate company of cement manufacturing. They earn billions per year, and they were paying me $29 per month. Then there was another one, Schneider Electric. I think they might be a German company. I looked them up, based originally in Germany, but they're now all over the world. Again, billions of euros and billions of dollars in revenue every year, giving me $29 per month. And the third one was JCB, which apparently in the UK is synonymous with excavator, the big earth moving equipment. I looked them up, world's biggest manufacturer of earth moving equipment. paying me $29 per month. And these companies, these types of customers were the ones not churning. And that made me realize, like, okay, so maybe this is actually a bigger target market. And when I looked into those customers, I found out that it was product managers inside of them that were using me.
I got to ask, what does that feel like when you know that there is a company that makes, I don't know, millions, billions maybe in revenue, and they pay you for your product $29? What did that feel like instead of having an indie hacker paying you $29?
I was thinking, how dare they only pay me $29 per month? It's a good question, because if I had been charging more, would they have become customers in those early days? My product was pretty unpolished in the beginning, and the marketing was not so sleek. And maybe the price was the one thing where they're thinking, we're not sure about this, but at least at this price, we can't go wrong. I don't know. Maybe if I'd been already charging $100 per month, which is what I now charge as the standard plan, maybe they would have given me three and a half times as much money.
But also might not have given you any chance, right? So
exactly.
We don't really know, right?
But I have this question for you. What's better, to get three customers paying $30 per month or one customer paying three customers paying $33 per month or one customer paying $99 per month? The revenue is the same. Which would you rather? I had to ask myself the same question. I'm actually curious to hear what you have to say about this. What would you prefer?
So when my product comes out, it will probably have a pricing tag that's similar to that. So that's a realistic question I will have to ask myself some months down the road. I'm not sure, because regarding B2B, you always want to have a high price tag, right? Because then people actually think that you're worth something. And if the price is too low, it can't be something good. But with B2C, it's different. So our products are both rather B2B. I gotta tell you, I'm not sure. Because obviously, if the one customer cancels, you lose all of your revenue in that example. And if in the other one, you spread the risk.
Mm-hmm.
But everything that I've seen in the indie hacker bubble suggests that the higher your pricing is, the less trouble you have with your customers, the more enterprisey they become. I would probably pick the one higher paying customer. I'm not sure. What would you have done in that situation?
So to everybody listening, this is a really good chance to ask yourself what you would do also. It's a really good mental exercise to go through. And I don't think there's a right answer. It has a lot to do with your product and what you're looking for and whatever. Say those three customers paying $33 per month. Let's say one of them is no hassle whatsoever, and they never send you a support email. Number two, maybe they send you one a year. And number three, the other ones who are in your inbox every day complaining about everything. Put the price up to $99, and let's say that two of them drop out. Which two are going to drop out? I'm telling you, it's the one that's writing to you every day is the first one to go.
Mm-hmm.
You have more risk when everything's coming from one customer, but it's a lot less work, a lot less hassle. It's not like you have a third less support. It's like you have a 10th or a 20th or a 50th of the support you would have otherwise. And that's really surprising. We think, oh, people pay more, expect more. But actually, the bigger the company, the bigger the price tag, the more likely they are to have a really good in-house IT team who they'll turn to first for any problems. And they won't. And the lower the price, the more likely they are to think, oh, this person from this indie hacker company is always answering my emails. So I'm going to keep asking them questions, even though I could Google it myself. Even if it has nothing to do with their product, I'm going to write to them.
Yeah, that's
now
kind of...
we're talking about one versus three customers, but in reality, it's like 1,000 versus 3,000 or 100 versus 300.
And then it doesn't really matter anymore, right?
Exactly. With one customer, yeah, if you lose them, that's bad. But if you've got 100 customers versus 300, 100 paying three times as much, you've still got that diversified risk.
Yeah. And at that point, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. But getting back, because you told me before the podcast, that's an interesting story that you have to tell. How did you go with the idea of FeatureUp, which you obviously did something before that, right? Wasn't your first idea. So how did you go, or why did you go with the idea of FeatureUp? And then how did you get the first 10 customers that then paid the price that you went with?
Do you want the really short version or the really long version?
Oh, you can do the long version if you want to.
So the previous product I had, the first one that enabled me to give up the life as an overpaid IT consultant in Frankfurt, was a consumer app, B2C app, ran on Macs originally. And that just had a lot of support to do. And I was also drowning in feedback. No matter how many features we added, we just got more and more requests. And I found it really hard to manage this. So I created Feature Upvote partly as a way to scratch my own itch to solve that problem. But first, I also asked people around, the other people I knew who ran software companies, what they thought about the idea, if they would use such a product, et cetera, et cetera. And some people outrightly said, no, I wouldn't want a product where people can, where my competitors can see what ideas my customers are asking for, because they'll just go and do them. Or there were other things like that. But some people said, I've been looking for this product. At the time, there was an alternative product that was enterprise only, user voice. It had started cheap and then gone enterprise only. You had to, if you couldn't even sign up for a demo, you had to get on a sales call and whatever. And I remember running the idea past somebody and he said, I've lost count how many times I've been about to contact user voice. And I knew then, okay, at least one person wants my product. And a couple of other people said, tell me when it's launched, I'll probably buy it. Turned out they didn't, but at least in my mind, it gave me this. But that's just part of the story. So part of the story is I wanted to get another product. I wanted to get away from a consumer app. I was sick of it. I didn't like the problem domain anymore. I was ready to move on. But I had a real misgivings about doing a SaaS. And that's because SaaS products have to be on 24 hours a day, mm-hmm. 7 days a week, all through the year. Christmas Day, New Year's Eve, Easter, birthdays, weekends. It's this expectation that it's available all the time. And that sounded to me really stressful. But then I was listening to a podcast and they were interviewing this guy who had acquired such a pretty basic SaaS app. And he said he just decided that he wasn't going to be interrupted in the middle of the night. He said his product was not so important that the company would grind to a halt, that the customer's company would grind to a halt if this product was down for a few hours. And he said there was at one time he did get a message on a Friday night that from somebody said, oh, I can't log in or your product's down. And he said, oh, okay, we'll look into that in the morning. And I was blown away. Like, you can say that to a customer? You don't have to drop everything and just get everything fixed right now. And it made me realize if the product domain is the right product, you can get away with that. If you're running something like Stripe, of course, it's got to be running all the time, or GitHub, or something in which company relies on it being available all the time. But if you do a product that just allows customers to vote on feature ideas, is it really going to hurt anybody if it's unavailable for a few hours every now and then? Now, I don't plan on downtime. We have very little downtime. But just the idea that I'm not going to have people screaming at me because their company is grinding to a halt because I've got some problem. This was really important. And this is the second reason why I chose to do feature upvote as opposed to many of the other different ideas I could have gone with.
I think that's a very clever idea. And I'm very happy that my own product is pretty much the same in that regard. It doesn't really matter that much if it's down for a few hours. I think I picked something really right. Good there.
But I learned quickly that you don't tell this to potential customers. If you're listening, sure. And you're a potential customer, just ignore everything you've just heard. I learned really quickly that customers do actually care about you really feeling a sense of responsibility for the product. And I have that. But it's just this idea that if there is some downtime, I don't have to feel like I'm hurting other people's businesses.
You don't plan with downtime, but it's just good to know.
And we do a lot of stuff to avoid it. But I think, it's a quite convoluted point, but I feel like you understand it.
Yeah. We had the same conversation with Benedicta Rowe in episode 3 on this podcast, where she also was like, I think her product went viral on Twitter and the server, I think, crashed or something from all the load. And she was on a horseback riding weekend with her daughter, I think. And it was like, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine on Monday as well. That might not be the perfect customer experience, but her tool was also a free tool. So how much can people really complain? So yeah, I get the point. Getting back to the customers though, how did you then go about getting the first few of them on board on your platform?
As I said, my audience or the people I was targeting were small software companies. I had it really well defined. 100 self-owned or bootstrap software companies with a team of up to 5 people or revenue up to $50,000 per month. That was exactly who we were aiming for. I figured the person with just the one product at $1,000 MRR, they're not going to pay. But with $50,000 or $20,000 or so on, maybe they'll see value in it. So if I want to reach these people, what's the best way to do that? To go to where these people are. So I was already a member of an active forum. where it was other people like this, not the one I mentioned earlier, just another one. I was also a member of a private one. I think it might have even been MicroConf or Startups for the Rest of Us. I think they had a private community at the time. You had to pay a little bit of money to join, but it wasn't much. And then I was a member of another private community. And I just told these people on this what I was doing. But here's the problem. If you just come onto a forum and say, hey, I have this product, use it, they're going to see you for what you are. You're just like a fly-by spammer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I knew for some months in advance that I was going to do this product and launch it. I think I got the idea in November 2016, and we did a private beta in February. So that gave me 3 months. And during that 3 months, I made the goal of being the most helpful person on all three of those forums, the two private ones, the one public one. If anybody asked a question which I could half answer at all, I would answer. And it wouldn't be a sentence. I would answer paragraphs with examples and so on, so that I would have the reputation as that really helpful person. And occasionally I might, if I had something that was troubling me, some problem, and I felt that people there could help, I would ask, and I would always say, I'm working on this SaaS product called Feature Upvote, blah, blah, blah. And this is the problem I have. So I start dropping the name in. So 3 months pass, or in one case, a lot longer because I've been on the forum for a long time. And then I say, today I'm announcing the launch of. By this time, I built up so much credibility and goodwill that I got tons of feedback. I got people promoting the product for me, recommending it to their friends. And that's where I got my first signups. And I think even my first paying customers were from there. In fact, I think we still have some customers today still with us, still paying from those very early days. Not all of them churned. So that was one part of the strategy. And the other part was realizing how I find products, which sometimes it's word of mouth, but sometimes it's going on to good old Google and typing tool for tracking feature requests or something like this. And I'd see answers. And I thought, I need to do the same. I need to have content like that. So the content I wrote, maybe the first 5 or 10 pieces of content, were always on this theme: feature request tracking, how to do feature request tracking, a tool for feature request tracking, or identifying that user voice was our big alternative, and a low and affordable alternative to user voice, I think was the keyword. And I'd say about half of our first customers were from those communities, and half was from the early people finding us through Google searches.
I think it's so funny that you mention as well diving into a community and being very helpful and expecting nothing in return, because the episode that will air before this one with Kevon Chong, who is also a big Build in Public community head, he said exactly the same, like dive into a community of people that are potential customers, help them however you can, and do it without expecting anything in return. And so I think it's so funny that you are the second guest in a row that says that's so important. I think it is.
Yeah. And then for a while there, I inherited a forum, I said was a public forum. After a while, I think the people who are running it began to realize that every day they went on the forum, there was another comment or post by me, and they were ready to move on. So they actually offered me to take over the forum, which I did for a while. And then I realized one of the problems of running such a forum is the flyby people who come in and drop the one post and they never come back again. The one post promoting whatever they're doing. And even people sometimes even engage and ask them questions. They don't even bother answering those questions. So I started getting pretty hostile and just deleting. If somebody had never communicated before and their first post was just me, it's just delete or hide or whatever.
I think that's also the one thing that I would say to anyone who tries to market their product on Reddit, for example. Because if you're just going to go into a community, let's say podcasters, for example, there's a community for podcasters on Reddit for sure. And your first post is, this is my product and you should try it, you will get banned.
Yeah.
100% yeah. You'll get banned.
And it doesn't take much brain power to work out why that is. Put yourself in the shoes of the person running the forum or the subreddit or whatever, moderating the subreddit. Don't think you're unique with this idea of coming in and posting, hey, I have this product, come and buy it. Like, this is happening all day, every day. So think in the terms of the people. If you are running the forum, what would you want from somebody? You'd want somebody being an active participant.
Yeah, I think that I have to write this down somewhere in my room to always remember. The last few guests have always mentioned that. Then going from like the first customers that you had, obviously those, they're paying $29. So that's not some like life-changing money at that point. How did the journey go for you from zero MRR to a point where you could make Feature Upvote your main job if you wanted to?
Okay, I'm going to answer an implied question there, which is, did you really charge $29? Although that was my list price, Mm-hmm. I was so desperate for these first customers and I had no self-belief in what I was doing. Like all of us, even though I'd had successful products in the past, I still felt like an imposter. And I would offer crazy discounts to people who weren't even asking for them. So $29 per month was our standard price. And we had $19 per month bootstrapper price to anybody who asked or a question or anything. It's, oh, you look like a bootstrapper. Here's the bootstrapper price. And in one case, I even had somebody paying $15 a month. And you know what? They're still paying me $15 per month to this day. So how many customers would you need at $15 per month to make $10,000 per year? Whenever I'm on a podcast, I lose my ability to do mental arithmetic. So I'm just going to get the calculator on my phone, resist the temptation to look at notifications. 660, that's a bit evil, 666 customers you need paying. How hard it is to get 666 customers and to keep them? The churn rate at that, again, I'm going to look at my phone's calculator because of the mental arithmetic problem. So at the price like that, you're going to have 10% churn. The customers you're getting are going to churn heavily times 0.1, which is 10%. You're going to need 66 new customers per month just to stay even. And it's hard to get 66 customers per month. Really hard.
Yeah, that sounds,
especially for the people without a marketing budget. That was been a stray from your question. You were asking me, getting from $29 per month or $15 per month to... So it took a couple of years until I was actually earning enough from it until I could say, this is my income. I told people from early on, I'm profitable. And really, if I look back, was I being honest, really? Yes, I was earning more from it than it was costing to run. But not if you look at the work I was putting in per hour. Like I was really earning like a tenth of minimum wage or something. And furthermore, I soon discovered that I didn't enjoy the content writing for the website. And I also realized that was when that content writing started to work, I realized that was a really important thing to keep doing. So quite early on, I hired somebody to come and help me, a freelancer to help with content. Originally, she was just coming to help with one or two articles, but somehow it ended up becoming an ongoing thing. And I was paying her all the revenue of the company, all the revenue of the product for quite a while. But it seemed to me to be a good investment. A smart customer, a smart listener might ask, if you were giving all your money to freelancers, what did you live on? What did you pay the rent with? Which is a good question. And that was from the previous product that then had got acquired and gave me quite a nice cushion. And that makes me wonder, at what point does it stop being a bootstrap product? What point am I not self-funded? If I had this money from a previous sale, can I really call myself a bootstrapper or am I just an investor in my own product?
That's an interesting one because all the indie hackers that we know that are having a big following on Twitter or something usually have sold one or two products at that point, right? Are they still indie hackers?
Yeah,
the one thing that I always said that I don't want people on the podcast because it's an indie hacker podcast that are heavily VC funded. So I think that's something where you're definitely not bootstrapped at no point. But I think if you're just living on your own money, a lot of indie hackers go the route of working as freelancers or full-time even and doing it on the side. And they basically do the same, but they just have to make the money first to then spend it on the other side. So I think you, at that point, at least for me, from my understanding, you're still an indie hacker, I think.
Good. I 100% own my own company, right? And I have nobody else owns a cent. And in fact, the first product, the consumer app, I did do that while working full-time. I would get up early at sunrise, work for 2 hours on that, then go to a 4 days work in the office, then go home and then answer whatever outstanding support emails there were. So yeah, I did that for maybe 6 months before I was able to change there. I think that's probably a story for another day. That's so far in the deep dark past. But yeah, it would be about 2 years until I could, if I had really cut costs, I could say that I'm happy with the money I'm making on Feature Upvote. I'm now no longer feel like I'm earning below my potential.
We, like in the indie hacker space, especially the last few years when it grew, there is this notion of dropping an idea like after 2 or 3 months if you can't get enough customers. Obviously, your path, I think you started with Feature Upvote in 2017, has been different. What's your opinion on this? What do you think about that?
That's a really hard decision to make. I understand why some people do drop it. At some point, you just don't want to waste time on something that's not working. On the other hand, 2 or 3 months is just not long enough to tell. I would look at some other things before dropping a product after 2 or 3 months, an attempt at a product. I'd ask, are there already successful competitors? If so, this is a good sign. This means there is an active market. If I can't find any competitors, it's probably because it's not a very good idea. At this point, all the obvious ideas have been done, and all we're doing is rehashing, making new versions of them, or taking an existing idea and customizing it for a particular market. 2 or 3 months. If you're writing lots of web page content and you're not getting any traffic, although these days they say SEO is getting harder than ever. Yeah. And yet, if you just do something for 2 or 3 months and then quit and then do something else for 2 or 3 months, I don't think you're going to get anywhere. It's never enough time to find out. And then how are you trying to find customers? So you're just like telling people on Twitter or Reddit that you're doing this. Typically not a very good place to find customers. Or are you actually going to where the potential customers are and are you getting no interest? So it's a hard question and I don't have an easy answer.
Because obviously 2017 has been a very long time ago and you're still working on feature upload. How did you keep yourself motivated? How did you decide, no, I'm not going to quit after 2 or 3 months. It's going to take longer. What was your thought process there?
The fact that I was getting some very positive feedback for early on, that even before we started charging money, I think the first 2 months I didn't even charge money. And people were trying the product and using it, going to look at every single sign up to see what they were doing with it. And a lot of them were actually using it. A lot of them, not a lot, but some. And just the positive feedback I was getting from people. Despite that, it's too easy to look back and say, yeah, I knew what I was doing and I knew it was going to work. But that's not the case. I was filled with self-doubt. I remember getting this really bad feeling of stress, especially once we got to about $2,000 in MRR. At that point, that's a good sign that this could go somewhere. But if it doesn't, it's also enough that I'm going to get stuck on this thinking, oh, I can make it. And if I can't, how much time are we going to spend going on this month after month, year after year? Luckily, it did keep growing. It grew quite solidly. I can't remember the exact rate, but quite a linear growth for a while there. I think it's really useful to know that almost all of us go through that enormous feeling of self-doubt in the early days. Now I feel quite comfortable that this product's probably going to work. The fact that I've actually been living off it for years and I have a team and so on. But yeah, that self-doubt, it can be crippling.
I think there's also, I've seen it so much on Twitter with very successful indie hackers where even those people still have doubts and don't know if they should continue a product or not. I think you just have to accept that's part of the process and it's not going to vanish at any point or any MRR point.
No, I think the type of stress changes. I don't think I feel like an imposter. I think the imposter syndrome's gone now, at least as far as feature upload is concerned. Although I still, like every time I learn of a new competitor, I still just, my spirit drops a little bit and thinking, oh no, they're going to destroy us. And of course, they never do. The market's big. Yeah. And I think a good question is, how do you deal with that stress? How do you deal with that self-doubt? You just keep it all to yourself. I don't think that's very healthy. I'm very lucky to have a girlfriend who I can share stuff with about this. And she's a good listener and it's very supportive and encouraging to people listening. If you are also going through that self-doubt of the early stages, it's so good just to have somebody you can regularly talk to and share it with, someone who's willing just to let you talk about it without trying to solve your problem.
Yeah, I have the same setup here pretty much. If we are both freelancers and also both have product ideas and stuff, so we can talk about this. I think it's tremendous help. And if you don't have someone like that at home, get someone from the community that holds you accountable but also listens to you if you have a bad phase. Yeah. And that really helps.
I find it so much more helpful if it's an in-person meetup too, not just somebody over the internet where we're all putting on kind of a facade and our best face on the internet, but if it's somebody I can catch up with for a coffee or a beer or a walk in the neighborhood and just talk about the stuff, so that's really nice.
Regarding your competitors, because you just mentioned them again, and I can remember a question I wanted to ask you earlier. You already said that you didn't want your competitors, like a product like Feature Upload, obviously then a competitor can go and see what a customer of yours might be building next, right? And they know what kind of way you will go. And the same is true for data that you shared about Feature Upload in public and your blog posts and stuff, how the business is going and what kind of marketing you're doing and stuff like that. Like, where is the where is the limit, what kind of information you should share and what you shouldn't share on a journey like that? I know that you have a little, like you have your own opinion on this. How transparent should we be?
So until about a year ago, I had my own podcast and I would talk quite openly about the challenges I had in terms of marketing, especially of feature upvote. And then I noticed that there are some competitors who, whatever I just talked about I was doing, they would go and do. Oh, I'm going to write a page on this topic, they'd write it. Oh, I'm going to try and run ads here, they're going to do ads and whatever. And so it's a bit sad, but it made me start being less hesitant to share the gritty details of what I was doing. Why wouldn't you listen to a podcast? If your competitor's got a podcast and he's talking about what he's trying and what's working and what's not working, why wouldn't you listen to it? So I can understand why people were doing it. Didn't make that much of a difference to my business. I don't know, maybe not, but just the fact that I felt like I was giving people an insight into my company. You know what I should have done? Is given like false information. Oh, and then I decided to take my entire savings and pour them into Google Ads in Bangladesh or some country in which we're probably not going to have the income level high enough to pay. But no, I didn't do that.
Would maybe have been a good idea to have two different podcasts and promote the fake one and only have the other one private for people actually interested or something like that. Yeah.
But do you want me to touch on about what it's like with feature upvote when your board is public and your competitors can see what your customers are asking?
That would be the other one. What do your customers think about this, that they pretty much share openly what they are working on?
Yeah. So some potential customers or some people I talked to when I was doing my initial research simply told me, I wouldn't want to use this. I wouldn't want my competitors to see this. Now, my thinking is your competitors have their customers, you have your customers. Their customers are probably a different subsector of the market, or maybe there's something different about them. If your competitor is listening to what your customers are asking for, they're not listening to what their own customers are asking for, and they're making a big mistake. Customers don't care what the competitor's doing. My customers care what I'm doing. I think it's not as bad as people think when your competitors can see what your customers are asking for, if it means they're ignoring their own customers. And let's face it, I had customers asking for single sign-on, SAML single sign-on, which is very enterprisey. Now, if you're my competitor and your customers are all like a different, are not enterprisey, and you went and did single sign-on, SAML 2.0 single sign-on, you've just wasted your time. Like, it's, your customers weren't wanting that. Whereas for me, it makes sense because it is what my customers are asking for. So yeah, you should listen to your customers, not your competitors' customers.
Okay, so we got that cleared up. Since feature upvote has been so long on the market, you already mentioned content marketing as something that works pretty well for you guys. Is there something else that you tried? I know that you're not like, as I am, we're both developers, right? We're not the biggest marketing friends. But what did you like try over the years? What worked and what didn't work at all?
So what haven't we tried? I've sponsored forums and newsletters and podcasts. I've advertised on Reddit and Google Ads. I've gone to conferences where I hope to get into conversation with potential customers. Overlooked one important detail. I'm extremely introverted. So when you put me in a room of strangers, I just don't want to talk to any of them. So that one was a dud. And there's so many things you can try and so many things I have tried. And what's really hard is knowing, it's the question you asked about giving up on a product after a couple of months. It's the same with a marketing technique. After a couple of months, has the marketing tactic or technique failed? Or have you just not tried long enough? Or have you just not done it correctly? So something I have learned is to get outside expert help, even if it's just for a single session. Somebody I follow on Twitter wrote recently the value of finding an expert on that particular thing you're trying to do, such as, for example, Google Ads, and just booking them for a phone call for just, even if it's like hundreds of euros, hundreds of dollars for them, it's worth it if it saves you a lot of effort and a lot of money experimenting. And generally, you won't have to pay hundreds, but just it's a strategy I've overlooked. I have talked to some experts, but this idea of just making it as part of the process is, okay, find an expert about Google Ads, Reddit Ads, sponsorship, etc. Talk to them, ask them what to do, what to avoid that would be wrong, whether they think it would work in my case and whatever, I think is a really underlooked tactic.
I think, yeah, because obviously you can't be an expert in all of this, right? I'm trying to dive right now into the SEO part of marketing, and it's you realize that it's a rabbit hole that just keeps on going and going.
Yeah.
And you
know, the first thing about SEO is just to get something written. People try to optimize the heck out of it with everything, but you're already so far ahead if you just actually start writing some articles that have targeted like keywords in the titles. All the other stuff you're supposed to do, such as the so-called technical SEO, internal backlinks, external backlinks, or whatever, that stuff's like fine-tuning. The first part is actually just getting something out there. But they say, I've been reading that SEO is getting really hard with the rise of AI-generated content. Now, if you want your content, it's just such a flood of SEO content on everything conceivable. It's making it really hard for SEO to work. I don't know if that's the case or not, and it worries me a little bit because that has been a really good channel for us.
I think, and I'm not an expert in SEO, so take it with a grain of salt, but we had Ilias on one of our episodes, who is an SEO expert, and he was actually of the opinion that Google and all the other search engines will probably start de-ranking stuff that contains AI-written content. And his number one tip for all the SEO things that you should do was to write really good articles that solve the problem that the customer is looking for. So if they Google something like, how do I set up a podcast? And you are answering that question very nicely. Mm-hmm. I think he was of the opinion that that blog post will probably still be on the first page, maybe the first result if you Google something like that. So we will have to see what AI will do. Ilias was of the opinion that it doesn't matter that much. I'm not sure.
Okay. This one very important point in what you just said, write very good content. That sounds easy. It's actually really hard to write really good content. And I've tried various writers, and the difference between somebody who can write really good content, particularly with having knowledge of the field they're writing about, it's such a better result as opposed to just getting something churned out by somebody who can write well but doesn't know the problem domain. Hey, we've got a form on our sign-up form. We've got a field that says, how did you hear about us? Mm-hmm. And some people answer it. Lately, people have been writing ChatGPT, which really amazed me, because in ChatGPT, how do they find us through that? I guess like they might search for like feature tracking tools or a way for customers to upvote suggestions or something. But then how does ChatGPT know about us? It doesn't really know anything. It's not sentient, but how does this information get to ChatGPT? And I figured probably from the well-written content, the SEO content we've been doing. So it made me wonder if it's still working, the SEO content, but it's just like a level of indirection now with chat passing the information on.
I think you're right with that, because having talked to ChatGPT a lot, I love generative AI and have done a lot of stuff with OpenAI and also Anthropic for the product I'm building. It's built on top of Anthropic, not ChatGPT. And what ChatGPT does, especially lately, often, is just Googling exactly, or using Bing, Googling exactly what you asked it. So if you have a really good blog post that has ranked for SEO before, it will now also be the result that ChatGPT picks up in its search for the answer. So you might be right that it's just more one more abstraction there. Yeah.
So the other type of content marketing we've been doing is this. It's hard sometimes to differentiate between SEO and content marketing. And SEO is like, I guess it's writing content that answers very specific questions, right? Whereas content marketing is much broader. So we're experimenting with writing something almost book length that's helping people with the problem domain we have, which is really what feature do you build next in your software? Mm-hmm. That's really what feature upvote's helping with. You might say it's to help with manage feedback and let people vote, but that's what it does. But really it's because people don't know what to build next in their software, and we're helping to decide that. So yeah, we're experimenting with writing something really long, like lots of chapters and so on. I'm a little bit worried that we'll do all that and it will turn out to be a big waste of time and money. But it's also the sense of being proud of what you're doing. And I'm not proud. I wouldn't be proud of a site that just had lots of AI-generated content that was just like had no love and no opinion and no professionalism put into it. But I am proud if we create this very good quality long-form content that's really thinking about how can we help our customers rather than, or not even our customers, how can we help people who have the problem that's in the domain we're solving? Maybe they won't even be our customers, but
and that product is that kind of planned as an info product in itself, or is it like a really huge blog post? What's the idea behind that?
Reuse. So haven't quite nutted out of the details. So I've already started working on some bits with the writer I'll be using, who is taking my half-written notes, half-written articles, and then turning into something more solid and it's augmenting with research. It will be something where you can reuse as blog posts. So each chapter will be able to turn into a blog post with some tweaks, into a video, into some LinkedIn content, maybe some Twitter threads, although I think maybe it's not the right place for that. And maybe even some newsletter content in the future if we go down that path. And we're doing this writing with the idea that we want to be able to reuse it in lots of places. But ultimately, it will be probably a PDF or a mini site, which people, or both, in which people can just go, yeah, this stuff's really helpful. I'm bookmarking this. I'm sending this to my colleagues. I'm downloading this PDF and I'm going to read it on the train on the way home.
So it's pretty much what Ilias has suggested, right? Like a huge value given away probably for free, right?
Yeah.
Just to point to your product. I think that's a great idea.
And every chapter will somehow tie back to feature upvote. Come on. It's our content. Of course, we're going to mention feature upvote in it. We're not going to be so outrageous to say, oh, this problem you have, feature upvote's the answer. But we will say, oh, feature upvote can help in this way with this problem, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, we will see how that works out.
Yeah, well, it's a year-long project. So you'll have to talk to me in a year from now and I can tell you if it's successful or not.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe we can ask the listeners right now. I was thinking about actually launching like an update series of this podcast, talking to the same guests again and say, okay, how did your journey go? Did it go completely like we thought about it on the podcast, or did it go completely in a different route? So that might be the perfect project to do that in a year.
Where are they now? I'm sure that will suffer from a lot of survivorship bias, right? The ones who actually didn't go anywhere, they won't want to talk to you again.
Yeah. It's probably hard to get them back on, yeah. One more thing that I wanted to talk to you about is that you not only have feature upvote now, but you also launched a coaching business now. So what was the thinking behind that? And also, you have to, like, this question hurts, and as I'm being educated to be a systemic coach myself, I can understand the question, but I would love to hear your answer. Coaching instead of doing more of feature upvote. So how did you get the idea for coaching, and why do you coach instead of just expanding your business even further instead?
That's a hard-hitting question. So I mentioned that I had the podcast myself for a few years, bootstrapped, and something strange started happening over the years that I was running that podcast. Friends of mine who had been running successful businesses before I ever started doing it, who I looked up to, who gave me inspiration, started coming to me for advice. And I thought, why are they doing this? And I realized it's because I had this podcast, I was talking about stuff, and it gave me an air of authority. It was really weird. I wasn't expecting this. And it meant that it also helped me think through ideas. So you can have a belief about something you should do in business, but then if you try and talk about it for half an hour or an hour, week after week, it really forces you to think that idea through well and to abandon the ideas that you realize actually don't hold water once you try to explain them, or to really strengthen the ideas you do. So I discovered that friends and also strangers or people who are listening to the podcast started asking me questions about their business in private. They would ask me particularly questions about pricing, sometimes about marketing and strategy and so on, or technology. And I really enjoyed this. I enjoyed answering their questions. I enjoyed then following up afterwards to see how my advice had gone, helping people with price rises was always a big popular one. And if I was enjoying doing this, how do I do it more? Coaching, right? Why not make it formal? Why not charge people money for it and do it in a way on a regular basis? So that's why I'm doing it. Now, the second part of the question, the mean hard-hitting part is, why not just do work on my product, which is surely a better use of my time? And this is true. If we're looking at it in sheer financial terms, any moment not spent working on feature upvote and working on something else is a poor use of resources. But I don't optimize for wealth. I earn enough money for my company to pay the rent, go on holidays and put some in savings and support my family. I don't want to get into this cycle of always trying to have to earn more and more, with the only end to that is eventually you die, right? Mm-hmm. That's how a lot of us think. So I try very hard not to think like that and instead think, how would I best use my time given with the financial resources I have now? And the coaching, I want to give it a shot. I want to try this. I only just started a couple of months ago. I've been thinking about it for ages. I've now got to the point where my company's reasonably easy to run and quite sustainable. So why not do that thing I enjoy doing that I've wanted to do? I'm trying it for a year, and at the end of this year, I'll decide whether this is something that's working out for me or not. And one final part to answer that is I'm also charging decent money for the coaching, mm-hmm. right? Given the fact that it's taking me away from my business a little bit, I have to make sure it works for me financially.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you one question about that. One might consider your price is pretty premium. So they're starting at $500 for a monthly fee, right? Some people might consider that a premium price, not everyone. How do you justify the price for you? And how do you then sell it to people? Like it's still a lot of money, right? It's not something you just pay out of pocket. What's your thoughts behind that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's going back to basics of marketing. This has been a really good process of getting the coaching off the ground. Is I've had to go and go through all the basics of marketing I haven't done for years, such as who are you targeting? How much should you pick a niche? How small should that niche be? What's unique about what I'm doing? How are customers going to find me? How am I going to convince those customers that I'm the right person? And then given all that, what type of customer do I even want? And pricing is all part of that, right? So if I'm charging $50 an hour, that's going to attract a certain type of customer. If I charge $500 an hour, it attracts a different type of customer. Pricing sends a signal. It can also send a very strong, or one of those signals it sends is that I believe I'm good at what I'm doing. Would you really trust a B2B SaaS coach charging $50 an hour? You'd be thinking, if they're charging that, then probably like their business is not doing very well, or they're not very good at it. By charging more, it sends that very strong signal. It also allows me to eliminate a whole lot of people who I wouldn't be right for, which are those just starting out, really. Mm-hmm. I realized very quickly they wouldn't be the right person for me to coach. Another thing about the pricing is that unlike a SaaS product in which you can just sell repeatedly, it doesn't matter how many customers you have, it's still the same bits being delivered over the internet. The marginal cost of an additional customer is pretty close to zero with a SaaS product. With coaching, it takes up actual calendar time per customer. If I had 10 customers, 10, what do we say, 10 students or 10 coaching students, let's go with that word.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to need 10 times as much time as I do for one. So the price also allows me to control how many customers I'm likely to get. I'm not going to get 10 customers a month at $500 per month. I realize this, but I will get one or two. And that's why at the moment I have, so as I said, I just started this 2 months ago. I have my first student conversations with a couple of people who might be the second one, but that's all I'm doing for now, just aiming for a maximum of two while I feel my way through this, how best to do it.
And how do you then go ahead and find these people to coach? Did they find you on your own, or did you reach out to people to get to them? What was the process there?
I first announced it on Twitter, and I was blown away by how many people reshared and wrote nice comments saying, yeah, Steve's the right person for this. Steve's the one I always go to for advice, and so on. So that was really nice. I got testimonials before I was even coaching. One person I talked to quite a bit about it, he had been a coach for SaaS products, and he stopped doing that so he could focus more on the products. And he gave me some really good feedback, and he made me feel really comfortable that he thought I would be able to do it. And just hearing this, again, the imposter syndrome kicks in, and having this type of feedback is helpful.
And then I think you already answered this, but I'm still going to do the question and then see if I cut it out later. So when the coaching will pick up and become more, and you already said that you're limiting it to two right now, but what's your thinking? What's going to be the focus for your future up? What's still going to be the focus? Or is coaching possibly something that might make you even sell Future Upvote at some point?
I would say ask me that in a year's time. I have no plans to sell Future Upvote, but as the case is with small business owners, if the right buyer comes along, we're always going to sell. If somebody comes and pays something that's crazy outside of what you would sell it for and you like their mentality and their attitude, we're all sellers, right, for the right buyer. Maybe I'll just keep the coaching as a very small thing and keep doing my own B2B SaaS because it helps keep me sharp for the coaching. Actually, when I started looking for how other people advertise their coaching services for B2B SaaS, I found a few pages on Google and went and looked at them one by one. And none of them actually seemed to be running B2B SaaS themselves. And I was wondering, like, are you really the right person to coach if you actually haven't done this stuff? I realized sometimes the coach doesn't have to have done what they're doing, but I think B2B SaaS is very specific, right? So I think that was a selling point that I have made really drawn out on my landing page. Yeah, I think I've answered the wrong question there.
That's still fine. That's still fine.
I intend to keep the coaching quite small so that I enjoy it. If it's something I have to do a different student every day of the month, I think I'll stop enjoying it. So just a couple of students really gives me flexibility.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we both here, so me and my girlfriend also tried to hit this point. Obviously, freelancing is not that much fun because you're obviously building products for other people instead of yourself. I think the building it for yourself part is more fun. Being an entrepreneur is more fun than being a freelancer. But there is this kind of sweet spot you're trying to hit, right? Where all the stuff that you're doing is filling enough time and not too much time of your week. So you have time for your family or friends, but also not, and I'm not sure how you are, but doing one thing only is hard for me. So having different kind of revenues that come together, I think, is the goal that actually I am trying to hit. I'm not sure about you.
It's true that as business founders, we often lack the freedom that employees and freelancers have, which they can just move on to new companies, new projects, or even to new roles within a company, whereas we just have to do the same thing every day. And it actually, I think the boredom that some people feel in their business is a real issue. It's hard to stay motivated in a business when you're just getting bored of doing the same thing all the time. And now I think about it, that's definitely a part of wanting to do the coaching. It's something new and different. And if I can do that while still working on my business on Feature Upvote and just doing, say, half-time of Feature Upvote, which is more or less what I'm doing, that's good. I think that will work for me.
Is that the only thing you're doing to keep yourself motivated with Feature Upvote, or is there anything else that you would like to share with the world that keeps people from dropping their year-long projects that are actually profitable?
Okay, anyone watching the video version of this will see the color of my hair, right? You can see that I'm not your 23-year-old indie hacker doing their first product. I've got some experience, but I'm also aware that there's only so many new projects in me before it's retirement time. And like Feature Upvote's working. If I decide, I want to go and work on something new because I'm bored with that, it might take years to get it off the ground. It might never get off the ground. I might have to go through 5 or 10 different ideas. Or I could just stick with the thing that's actually working and find ways to make it enjoyable, such as doing some coaching or doing new parts of the product, trying new things like changing my role within it a little bit, which I have tried a little bit, didn't really work out. I actually tried to hand over most of the coding to somebody else, but it turned out it's really hard to find a coder who has the passion for a product that's not theirs and understands the product as well as the person who created it. So that was a failed experiment.
Yeah, but coaching will then probably be the next experiment now and seems to be working. So we will see.
Yeah.
Steve, we are getting close to the 1 hour mark. So I'm going to go to the finishing questions that we always have for all the guests. The first one being, what are you excited about right now that can be either technology and work related or completely not?
You didn't even have to finish asking that question. I already had the answer. 4 letters, HTMX. I am enjoying this so much. It's actually making me enjoy web development again. Are you familiar with it?
I have heard of it, but you can give us a small introduction if you want to, because I have not understood it completely right now.
Okay, so anyone who's a coder, you've got a link, like an A tag, a link in your code. And by default, it has an href, which sets where it goes to. If somebody clicks on that, it executes a request using the get method. I'm hoping everybody who listens is a developer. What if you want it to execute a post or a delete, or I forget the other options we have?
Patch. Also there in patch, yeah.
Patch and a couple of others. HTMX does that. Instead of using href, you use HTMX-get equals and then the URL, or HTMX-post, HTMX-delete. And suddenly, you don't have to do all these crazy JavaScript workarounds. In fact, a lot of JavaScript can be just ripped out and replaced. Now, of course, not everything can be done with the link, but this is the most basic example they have in their code. And furthermore, you can say like to this link or a button or a div, anything can be made clickable. It can execute a get, a put, a patch, delete, post. You can tell it like the result that comes back just replaces a particular div on the page. Don't do a complete re-update of the whole page. Just replace that, like the table or the customer field or something. That's all that gets back. So you've just got this like partial HTML coming back. And that stuff alone does so much of what until now you needed to do with a full JavaScript script framework. Now, it is clearly a JavaScript framework itself, this stuff. You can't just build without JavaScript. Mm-hmm. But you, as the user of HTMLs, don't need to do the JavaScript. And suddenly, it's just so much easier and quicker to implement this type of interactivity. It's so much simpler to code and maintain. After many years of getting a bit frustrated with how complicated web programming, web development's become, especially for CRUD-based apps. Okay, you're not going to use it for writing Figma. But for writing a basic CRUD app, which is really for a lot of the indie hackers, that's what we're creating. It just makes it so much nicer. So
could you
feel my enthusiasm? It's been years since I've been that enthusiastic about a new technology.
I will see. We will all see how HTMX turns out. I feel like the community is a little bit split about the idea, but we will see what the adoption is in 2 or 3 years now down the line.
There's alternatives to it. Similar concept with different names already part of Ruby on Rails and the PHP alternative to Ruby on Rails, whose name I forget. They all come with something like this now because they've all realized like for just that little bit of interactivity you need in a CRUD app, this approach is actually has a lot of advantages.
I also like the approach that Astro has done. Astro has seems to place itself on a point where it's a competitor to Next.js, which is such a big framework that you have to understand. And it does so many things, right? It can also be a serverless backend and stuff like that. But sometimes, and I've been in that position, I want to have a static app and I want just to have that one little interactivity in there. And that's where Astro lives, where I can put one React component or one Vue component in there and it does the interactive job and the rest is statically rendered. All the images are like dynamically sized and I don't have all the complexity of Next.js in there. So there's something like that, like some technology like that will probably survive the next few years. So I'm not sure which one it will be.
I hope so. I hope so.
I think so. I think and I hope so too that it will be. Yeah, we're at the last question, Steve. If you could give like one lesson or advice to someone who would now start out as a bootstrapper or an indie hacker, what would be your advice to them?
Charge more. I've stolen this from Patrick McKenzie. Somebody I've known for a long time on the internet. He used to say it all the time, charge more. Indie hackers are notorious for self-sabotaging themselves by not charging enough money. People who think that their product can have a free tier and a $9 per month tier, it's crazy. The economics don't work. Charge more, get rid of the free tier, start your pricing at $49. And if that scares you, try it and see what happens. Charge more. But fully acknowledging that's Patrick McKenzie's shtick there that I've stolen, but I fully have come to believe it, especially when I've been helping people who've contacted me via my podcast, et cetera, in the past, who have been asking for a price for help. Just so often, you just look at what they're charging and think, you're not charging enough money. People will pay more.
I'm going to pose a follow-up question here because it's something I'm also like personally affected by. What do you say to people that say, but I'm afraid nobody will buy if I feel like the product is only worth $19 a month, for example? How do I convince myself and maybe my customers that it's actually $39, $49 a month is okay as a price?
First, us developers are terrible like this. We all feel like this. Like, but this is so easy. Like, people are going to feel like I'm a fake. The people buying your product are not developers, probably. If they are, then you've probably got the wrong market. People are the business people. And if your product solves a problem for them, if it helps them get a job done, it's worth the money. Does it save them an hour's time, a week's time? Does it help them create something they couldn't do otherwise? Then it's worth the money. But there are some tricks you can do to overcome that natural developer mentality. One is to put the price up at $49. You say you wanted to charge 19, it's what you feel it's worth. It's not, it's worth more, trust me. But put the price at $49. And then for the first 3 months, have a line through it that says, we're in February now, until end of May 2024, it's $19, first 3 months only. And then Stripe or whatever payment processor you're using will allow you to automatically apply a coupon that gives them a discounted price for the first 3 months. And then after that, it goes up. And then you just see if they just keep paying after that.
Mm.
We think people are paying a lot of attention to what we do and that they'll criticize what we're doing. And actually, the hard part is actually getting people to notice you at all. That's much harder than getting them to pay you $49 per month once they know you exist and they like your product.
I will be using this advice and we'll see what the experience is like for me. And if any listener decides to do this, I want to hear from you as well.
Me too. Well, charge $19 for your first 5 customers and tell people this is a brand new product. Mm-hmm. And to reward those of you who are supporting us, we're charging you $19. But after the first five or the first 10 customers, it's going to be $29. And then after that, after 10 people get that, it's $39. And maybe that helps you to slowly get the confidence that people actually see value in what you're doing. Plus, it gives people an incentive to buy now before the price goes up. It's amazing how simple the psychology of human beings is sometimes. Once you put in any sense of urgency, people are so much more likely to get out the credit card and buy.
And I have seen actually that exact strategy I've seen working time and time again with Indie Hacker Project. So that might also be something worth considering for sure for any product. Yeah.
But hey, any price is better than no price. And when I see people, having an overly generous free tier, you'd only use a free tier if you really understand why you're having a free tier and you know what you're doing with it. People who just think they have to default to having one, crazy talk. And then the second problem, people who don't even launch their product because they don't know what to charge. Don't even let that get in the way. I'm telling you right now, if anybody listening, if you want to launch a product and you can't decide what to charge, you're going to start with 3 tiers. One at $49, one at $99, and one at $249. And here's the difference. The $99, basic. The $99 allows them to hide the Powered by Your Product link or allows them to add some custom CSS, something really basic that you as a programmer can code in no time, but actually adds value to the person. The third one, $249, priority support. You are guaranteeing to them that their support emails will be answered the same day. Now, of course, you're going to answer all your emails the same day anyway because you don't have many emails and you're so excited when anybody actually writes to you with your new product. But you're guaranteeing for the $249 per month people that you will answer the same day. Try that and you might be surprised that you actually get 1 in 10 people take the $249 tier and it's so much better than $9 per month.
I will get back to you on that for my product for sure, Steve. We are at the end of the interview. Thank you so much for taking the time and also for the last question being a very long answer, but I think so much value in there. Thank you for being here. And where do people find you on the internet?
So if you want a way for your customers to openly add and upvote ideas to improve your product, that's featureupvote.com. If you want to interact with me on the best way to do that is Twitter at Steve Off McLeod. And if you're interested in my coaching, that's steveoffmcleod.com. You can see I got late to getting the right domains. I couldn't get the off. I couldn't get Steve McLeod. So yeah, Steve Off McLeod. But Twitter, start with Twitter. That's where I am every day.
And you can find all of this in the show notes as always. Thank you for being here, Steve, and have a nice day.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor. Bye.
Bye.
And that's our episode. Thank you for sticking with us to the end. You can find me on Twitter with the username icebearlabs, that's icebearlabs. We have a website you can check out, go to codeandconquer.fm to find out more. You can find this podcast on Twitter, TikTok and Instagram with the handle @codeconquerpod and write us a mail at hello@codeandconquer.fm. If you're one of the people who listen to this podcast on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please consider rating us. It lets other people discover this podcast and helps us grow this even bigger. Thank you so much. Till next time.